this like a man and look Principal Petey in the eye. He really wanted to see me sweat. "Look Principal Petey in the eye," he said. And I did, for a moment. "You're not here to look at a pelican," he said. "You're here to look at Principal Petey." I'm not lying. If you had been there, you wouldn't have looked him in the eye either. You would have looked past him, like me. You would have looked at the wall over his desk, and you would have seen what I saw. The brown pelican. The beautiful brown pelican. The beautiful and noble brown pelican. One of the pages razored out of Audubon's book. I got 7 days of after-school detention and one more for not looking Principal Petey in the eye. But I couldn't help it. Could you? It wasn't the best day I'd had at Washington Irving Junior High School. Tuesday was a little better, even though that morning in English we finally started reading Jane Eyre by Miss Charlotte Bronte, which we were likely to be reading for a whole long time since it was 160 pages long, even in the abridgment, as you might remember. For the rest of that week, Miss Cowper read it aloud to us. I know. You're probably thinking that we were dying of boredom. But what was kind of surprising was that it wasn't so bad. By Friday, we were at this part when Jane is at the boarding school, and this jerk who runs it, who sort of reminds me of the principal of Washington Irving Junior High School, makes Jane stand on a stool because he wants everyone to think that she's a liar. Like she's been going over to the other team in P.E. or something absolutely horrible like that. So she's standing there, and everyone is supposed to stay away from her because the principal says that they should, and you think she's going to crumple and just give up. But you know what? She doesn't. She sort of reminded me of Lil, which I did not tell her, and which you shouldn't tell her I said either. So the story wasn't so bad. But what was bad was that Miss Cowper decided that beginning next week, she would make us take turns reading it aloud. She would read for the first 5 minutes of class to give us a running start, she said, and then she would call on the next alphabetical victim to read for the next 7 minutes. Terrific. So on Monday, she started with Otis Bottom, who read like he had written the thing himself. When he finished, and he read the parts after Jane was off the stool and trying not to wish that she could get even with Mr. Brocklehurst, the jerk, I almost wanted to stand up and clap. He was that good. Except that I really wanted to throw up. He was that good. Terrific again. When the period was almost over and Miss Cowper said, "We'll have 5 more new readers tomorrow," like she was promising a gift or something, I figured I'd better talk to her, because, you remember, I wasn't going to read Jane Eyre. So I waited until everyone left, even though I might be late for Mrs. Verne's class, and I knew that Principal Petey would love to see me waiting outside his office for another 30 minutes. "Miss Cowper," I said. She was putting pages away in a notebook, but she looked up at me. "I don't know if I want to read Jane Eyre out loud." "Everyone takes a turn, Douglas, even if you think you don't like the book." I looked around to be sure that no one was in the room to hear what I was about to say. "I like it well enough." "So what's the problem?" What was I supposed to say? I looked at her, like a chump. "Douglas, I know that Otis Bottom is a wonderful reader. It's a gift that he has. You may have different gifts, but that doesn't mean that you shouldn't try to read aloud." "I know that," I said. "Is it reading aloud in front of others that bothers you?"
"No."
"Good. Then I'll look forward to a gallant attempt when your turn comes," she said.
"You see how it is?"
Sometimes things go bad even when other things are going bad. I headed to Mrs. Verne's class, looking at the next few pages of Jane Eyre. I think that Charlotte Bronte ought to be shot. I mean, who uses words like these? I didn't know half of them. Well, most of them. Okay, I'm a chump. So what? And what was I supposed to do? I thought of Jane Eyre standing on her stool, everyone looking at her. I thought of the dying gull. I hate this stupid town. Detention that afternoon was with Mr. Ferris, because the eighth grade teachers took turns monitoring after school detention, which probably put them in really good moods. So I stayed in his room after school and waited for the other twisted criminal minds to come join me for 90 minutes of forced study. It didn't help that it was one of those perfect blue, cloudless days where the trees are starting to golden up and the breezes are cool like they are during a World Series, and you could imagine having a catch with Joe Pepitone or Horace Clark or someone like that. But instead, you're sitting in the physical science room and it turns out that you are the only twisted criminal mind. So you're all alone while Mr. Ferris works on his next lab preparation. I flipped through the pages of Jane Eyre. Hopeless. Somewhere far away, a dog barked. A happy bark. I flipped through Jane Eyre again. Very hopeless. Mr. Ferris looked up from his lab preparation. So, Doug Swiatek, what are you in for? Mouthing off to Coach Reed. He thought about this for a minute, his hand on Clarence. Generally, he finally said, it is neither wise nor prudent to mouth off to a junior high school teacher, especially to one who has been a sergeant in the United States Army.
Not even if the teacher is wrong?
Consider. Is it Coach Reed or you who is sitting in this somewhat dreary room that smells of vinegar on a beautiful October afternoon?
I see your point, I said.
However, since it is you and not Coach Reed, perhaps we can put the time to some good use, as you seem to have given up on Jane Eyre.
Have you ever seen the pelican in the principal's office? I said.
Are you trying to illustrate a principle of randomness, Doug Swiatek?
No, really. Have you seen it?
I have.
Don't you think it belongs back in the book it came from?
Mr. Ferris rocked Clarence thoughtfully. I understand it was a gift to him from the town council when he was appointed.
So you do think it belongs back in the book it came from?
Mr. Ferris smiled. In general, I adhere to the notion that things belong in the class to which they have been assigned. Which leads us to the periodic table. No more about the pelican. He walked over to the glossy chart hanging beside the chalkboard on the front wall. The periodic table arranges elements according to their physical properties and to what else?
Their atomic number.
Good. The table gives us the name of the element, here, hydrogen, the atomic number, here, 1, and the symbol, here, H. I know that you know the symbol for hydrogen already, so let's see if you can learn 6 more. Look at the symbols for the inert gases. Helium, neon, argon, krypton, xenon, and radon. I looked at the chart. He might as well have been speaking ancient Egyptian. All right, he said, and he walked to the other side of the board. Look at me, and tell me that symbol of the first inert gas, helium. I shook my head. He looked at me. Glance back at the chart, find neon, and tell me what the symbol is. I looked back at the chart. I shook my head again. Mr. Ferris looked at me for a long time. Then he walked back over to the chart and pointed.
N-E, I said. Good. Try xenon, he said. It has an atomic number of 54. XE, I said. Good. Now look over here at the transitional elements. He pointed to element 29. This is copper, he said. The symbol is?
Cu.
Good. He moved his finger down one element. The symbol for this one is?
Ag, I said.
Good. He moved his finger down again. And this one?
Au, I said.
He moved his finger over one. And this one?
Hg.
Good, he said. Doug, of Ag, Au, and Hg, which one is the symbol for silver? I didn't even have a guess. Ag, he said. And that was how Mr. Ferris figured out what no teacher had figured out before. Terrific. I think Mr. Ferris told Miss Cowper because in English on Wednesday, we all opened up Jane Eyre and Miss Cowper read her 5 minutes and then she called on Glenn Thomas, who was probably surprised, but he didn't say anything and got right to it. And Miss Cowper, and you may think I'm lying here, but I'm not, Miss Cowper didn't look at me until the end of class, just before the bell was about to ring and Jane Eyre was about to leave Lowood Institution. Douglas, she said. I looked at her. I had been waiting for something to happen, and I figured that this was it. Douglas, do you think that Jane Eyre should feel guilty for not being able to save Helen Burns from dying?
It wasn't her fault.
That's right, she said. It wasn't her fault at all. She looked at the whole class. There are some things in this world that we cannot fix, and they happen. And it is not our fault, though we still might have to deal with them. There are other things that happen in this world that we can fix. And that is what good teachers like me are for. A general groaning from everyone in the class, but not from me. Miss Cowper and I, we looked each other in the eye. Maybe, I thought. Maybe everything is not ruined forever. That day I was supposed to have my last after-school detention with Mr. Ferris again, but when I came in, he told me to report to Miss Cowper's room. How come? I said. Because I am a mean old crank who is likely to beat you if you don't, he said.
I think I better go to Miss Cowper's room, I said.
I think you better, he said, and started Clarence rocking. Miss Cowper was waiting for me when I got there. Just the person I need, she said. She held up a batch of Dittos. Their blue alcohol smell fluttered around them. I've been developing a county literacy unit, and I need a student to practice on. Would you be willing?
What do I have to do?
You play the part of the student who is learning how to read.
Are you a little suspicious here?
The student who is learning how to read, I said. She nodded. Miss Cowper, if this is because you think, show me what you've been working on with Mr. Ferris. I set my books down on my desk. I went up to the chalkboard. I wrote, A-G. This is the symbol for silver, I said. She came up to the board and took the chalk from my hand. She wrote, S-I-L-V-E-R. So is this, she said. Let's get started. I bet Clarence was rocking. I bet Clarence was rocking every day for the rest of the week, and every day for the next week when I stayed after school with Miss Cowper. And not for after-school detention, just remember, but so we could work together on her county literacy unit, and I could play the part of the chump student who didn't even know how to read. So she took me through the letters and the sounds they made by themselves and the sounds they made when they were working with one another. And then we opened up Jane Eyre and picked out words that pretty much looked impossible. But we figured them out because of what we were learning about the letters and their sounds working together. No one ever told me this stuff. How come no one ever told me this stuff? How come? And by the way, in case you want to know, AU is the symbol for gold, which has a hard G and one vowel that's a long O, and HG is the symbol for mercury, which has two vowels, E and U, even though Y is sometimes a vowel in words like my, fry, try, cry, because every word has to have one vowel at least. Did you know that? And the C is hard, not like in pace or scent, where the C is soft, but like in cure and cur and care. How come no one ever told me this stuff? On Saturday mornings during deliveries, I'd practice picking out new words in Jane Eyre, sounding out the ones that needed sounding out, and I'm not lying, there were plenty. A new servitude. There is something in that, I soliloquized. I mean, who talks like that? Do you know how long it takes to sound out a word like soliloquized? And even after you do, you have no idea what the stupid word means except that it probably just means said, which is what stupid Charlotte Bronte should have said in the first place. When I delivered Mrs. Mason's groceries, she saw that I had Jane Eyre stuck under my arm. Oh, she said, that was my favorite novel in school. It was? I soliloquized. Yes, she said. Have you gotten to the part where Bertha bites her brother and almost kills him? Mrs. Mason, I said, I haven't gotten to anything half as good as that. Keep with it. You will. That morning, she gave me 3 powdered sugar donuts. When Mr. Leffler saw Jane Eyre, he said, "You poor kid." "Did you have to read this in school, Mr. Leffler?" He nodded. "Fortunately," he said, "I got appendicitis in the middle of it and almost died. Best thing that ever happened to me. I couldn't go back to school for 3 weeks. How are you feeling?" "It's a new servitude," I said. "If I were you, I'd start thinking about pains in my gut." When Mrs. Doherty saw Jane Eyre, she said, "Do you like to read?" "It's complicated," I said. She thought for a minute or so, pushing back her kids like they were a tide about to flow out the door. "I'm looking for a babysitter for some Saturday nights," she finally said. "But you'd have to like reading, since not a single one of these kiddos goes to sleep without a book." I looked at how many kiddos there were. I figured she must have had trouble finding a babysitter if she was asking me, the brother of the twisted criminal mind. I looked at the 5 kids. 3 of them had something red dripping all over their hands. I was afraid to ask what it was. Mrs. Doherty was probably desperate. "It pays very well," she said. She was definitely desperate. "Now this is the part where I should tell you something. You know how I'm making $5 plus tips every Saturday? And we both know that's good money, right? You might remember that my father knows that I'm making $5 every Saturday morning. And he thinks that's good money, too. So he takes it, since I'm supposed to be helping out with the household expenses. It's about time," he says. So I'm living on the tips that I don't tell my father about, which is what you would do, too. Don't lie. "It's a deal," I said to Mrs. Doherty. 7 o'clock?
"Yep.
I'll have the books waiting for you."
"Terrific,"
Up at Mrs. Windermere's house, everything was quiet. No typing, no dinging. She came into the kitchen when she heard me putting things away.
What kind of ice cream did I order?
Mint chocolate chip.
That's a good kind of ice cream to eat when the god has fled, she said.
I guess that means no one was folding his wings beside her desk.
What is that book in your back pocket? She said.
Jane Eyre.
Ah, she said,
as if she had made a great discovery or something.
Come with me.
I put the mint chocolate chip ice cream into the freezer and followed Mrs. Windermere to her study. She ranged over a bunch of shelves and then pulled out three smallish, darkish books. She handed them to me.
That, she said, is a first edition of Jane Eyre.
I looked at her. I guess she thought this was pretty all-fired important.
A first edition, she said again. All three volumes.
Wow, I said. She sighed.
Skinny delivery boy, do you have any idea how hard it is to collect a first edition like that?
I looked over all the books on the shelves in her study. Looks like you're doing pretty well.
But this is Jane Eyre, one of the world's great stories. Love, betrayal, jealousy, the search for the true and complete self. It's worthy of a play. She stopped and stared at me. This smile slowly comes across her face and starts to fill it. And there's the god, she whispered, and she rushed to her typewriter. She rolled a page into it and her hands started flying.
You already know how.
I put the first edition of Jane Eyre back on the shelf and slid all three books in carefully because I guess it was all fired important. I sounded out words from Jane Eyre, the paperback edition, not the first edition, all the way back into town. And I stopped at Spicer's Deli for the really cold Coke that Mr. Spicer always gave me. I would have bought a pastrami sandwich if Mrs. Windermere had given me a tip, but I wasn't getting a tip anymore because the bill was going on her tab, which you might remember, and the other tips weren't enough to cover a pastrami sandwich and leave me much for the rest of the week. And I don't want to complain or anything, but a tip would have been nice, since it was me, after all, who brought the god back to her. That afternoon, when I got to the Marysville Free Public Library, Mr. Powell and Lil Spicer were waiting for me. Mr. Powell was trying to get ahead on his cataloging so that Mrs. Merriam wouldn't fuss at him, and Lil was speeding ahead on Jane Eyre. She was almost done. Terrific. We went upstairs together to work on the black-backed gull, or Mr. Powell and I did. Lil helped by letting me know what I was doing wrong.
Isn't there too much blood there? She said when I spread my drawing out. It gives the drawing drama.
His wing is slanted off to the side.
Point of view, I said.
And I think his neck is too far back. It's called composition.
And on like that until Mr. Powell told us both to hush, because he wanted to talk about Audubon's use of the white space around the wing, and the contrast in spatial perception that the two wings gave, and artist stuff like that. Lil hushed for a while, but she started again before too long. And do you think I minded? Do you think I minded when she leaned in right next to me to point something out? Do you think I minded that she smelled like daisies would smell if they were growing in a big field under a sky clearing after a rain? Do you think I minded when she touched my hand? You remember how I told you that when things are going pretty good, it usually means that something bad is about to happen? This is true. Just ask the black-backed gull. About halfway through October, as I was thinking that I'd have to start wearing Joe Pepitone's jacket to school because there wasn't anything else I could wear with sleeves that even pretended to reach my wrists, Someone broke into the Tools and More hardware store. It happened on a Sunday afternoon. The register got forced open and all the cash taken. There was a bunch of tools gone. A chainsaw, a drill set, a wrench set, and a bike, too, which made the brilliant policeman of stupid Marysville come to the conclusion that it must have been a kid who broke in. So guess whose house they came to on Sunday night? And they didn't want any of the thawed hamburgers or German potato salad my mother offered. Mr. Daugherty was one of the policemen. "Is your son home?" he asked.
"He's off with his friends," my mother said.
"Is your son ever home?" the other policeman asked. I think he was a little upset. "What's he doing with his friends?" said Mr. Daugherty.
"Just playing," she said.
She said it kind of hopefully. Mr. Daugherty looked at me. "Do you know where he's playing?" he said. "We have a few questions. We want to be certain he's all right."
"Sure. That's what they wanted."
I shrugged. "Thanks," said the other policeman. "You've been real helpful. We'll go look for him ourselves." They did. And it probably didn't help my brother that when he saw them, he took off on his stingray and made them chase him about 10 miles, and he made them crash two cop cars. And finally, they had to call the state police, who ran him down when one of his tires popped because he had taken a sharp turn on one wheel, which was something only a few people knew how to do, and he was one of them. He told us all this after Mr. Daugherty brought him home and sat with us while the other policemen searched through our garage and basement, and afterward asked my brother about 15 different ways if he had ever been inside the Tools and More hardware store. I could tell the other policemen didn't believe him all 15 times. It was harder to tell with Mr. Daugherty, except he said that maybe we should hold off on the Saturday night babysitting until things got cleared up. Terrific. After they left, my mother asked my brother the same question.
"You already heard me tell them."
"Tell me," she said.
"I didn't steal anything."
"Did you take anything from Mr. Spicer's deli?"
"No. Just because Lucas..."
"What Lucas did is over and done. I'm worrying about what you're doing."
"You don't have to worry about anything," my brother said.
"I am worried.
You don't believe me?"
My mother went into the kitchen. My brother watched her leave. He just stood there, watching her back as she worked at dishes in the sink. He stood there a long time. Then he said something she didn't hear, dared me to say anything, just one little thing, and went upstairs. I did my homework at the wobbly kitchen table, mostly Mrs. Verne's stuff, and copying a map of the Mississippi River from Geography, the Story of the World, which I want you to know was still as clean and perfect as the day Mr. McGraw-Hill sewed the cover on. I also drew costumes of the samurai tradition of Japan, where we'd gone with Mr. McElroy after we left China. And, of course, I did a few pages of Jane Eyre, who was settling in at Mr. Rochester's house, even though he hadn't shown up yet. At least, I think he hadn't shown up. I took my time. When I finally did go upstairs, all the lights were off and my brother was in bed. The covers were drawn up over his head. You know, when someone has been crying, something gets left in the air. It's not something you can see or smell or feel or draw. But it's there. It's like the screech of the black-backed gull, crying out into the empty white space around him. You can't hear it when you look at the picture. But that doesn't mean it isn't there. The trees were reddening and yellowing. You could see the color moving like a slow tide down the hills that rose on both sides of stupid Marysville.
One day it was only the trees toward the top ridges. And then the next, the color was coming down, first where the trees stood mostly by themselves, and then in bigger patches of red and yellow, until the green was holding out only in the cut-ins on the hills. And then, when the tops started to thin out and you could see the bare rock beneath them, the red and yellow reached the bottoms of the hills, and then the trees around town colored quickly, like they didn't want to miss the parade. Except the trees around the dump. Their leaves turned brown and dropped. Terrific. My mother and I raked them across the front dirt and burned them in the street. Do you know what that smells like? "It's the smell of fall," said my mother. "Lucas used to love to play in the leaves before we burned them. He'd rake them up and jump in and scatter them all, and rake them all up again and jump in again until he was covered in bits and pieces of leaves. Then he'd come get me, and we'd burn the piles, and he'd stand there all serious and still, like he was watching something far away." She shifted some of the leaves closer to the low flames. "He'll be back soon," I said. "I know he will." I looked at her face. She was watching something far away, too. "I hope there isn't any more trouble," she said. And so, you know, that's what I was thinking about in P.E. these days. I didn't want there to be any more trouble, mostly because my mother already had enough. So I was really trying not to get sent to visit Principal Petey again, even though it would almost have been worth it to see the brown pelican. But I was really trying. No funny business. No siree, Buster. And things were going okay, even though Coach Reed and I didn't talk much. We were finishing up the apparatus unit, which meant messing around on leather horses and parallel bars and ropes and the high bar, which people who are skinny and wiry like yours truly can do without breaking a sweat. Not that Coach Reed would ever say anything to me about that in a million, million years. I could have thrown a triple somersault, full layout dismount, and he wouldn't have said a thing. Pretty much he walked around the gym and hollered at Otis Bottom or someone else, and he wouldn't talk with me, and I wouldn't talk with him, and then he'd tell us to line up in platoons, and he wouldn't look at me. Which was fine. No trouble. Until the day he announced that he didn't feel like spotting us for another hour, so we should line up, and he'd count off two teams, and we'd play basketball. And he divided us into shirts and skins, and I got on the skins team, and Coach Reed went into his office, and I walked over to the shirts team and asked James Russell if he'd trade, and he said sure, and so we did, and Coach Reed must have been watching because he came back out of his office, yes siree, Buster, and he was not a happy coach. "He wondered what I thought I was doing," Sergeant's voice. I pointed out, and I think I pointed this out politely, that I thought I was about to play basketball. He told me, and I don't think he did this politely at all, that I should shut my mouth and get over to the skins team. Is this starting to sound familiar? Then James Russell said that he had switched with me. Coach Reed told James Russell that he wasn't talking to him, and he should mind his own business, and then he looked back at me and wondered if we hadn't already been through all of this before, and hadn't I learned anything at all. I could have said that I'd learned a whole lot. The periodic table, and Jane Eyre, and even the location of the brown pelican. But I didn't say anything, which is important for you to know so that you don't blame me for what happened. Coach Reed guessed that I hadn't learned anything at all, but he was going to give me a chance now. He told James Russell to put his shirt back on and get over to the shirts team, and when James said he was fine on the skins team, Coach Reed gave him the kind of look that said he was going to gut him if he spoke one more word. James put his shirt on and went over to the shirts team. "Sorry," he whispered when he walked by me. "Shut your face," Coach Reed said to him. Then Coach Reed, who is the kind of person that Joe Pepitone would probably want to pound into the dirt with his baseball bat, looked at me again. "Get over to the Skins team," he said. Growled, really. I shrugged. What was I supposed to do? I walked over to the Skins team. You could see I was really trying. "With your shirt off, Swiatek. You have to have your shirt off if you're on the Skins team." I looked around at the two teams. "I think we're all smart enough to remember who's on our team," I said. "It's not like we're gym teachers or something." Okay. So there I wasn't really trying. I guess that was sounding like Lucas. Coach Reed said, "Over there now," in a kind of double sergeant's voice, each word slow and apart and long, carrying a whole lot of atomic weight. "So are you going to shoot me if I don't?" I said. I think Coach Reed crossed the floor almost without touching it, and the words, "Who do you think you're talking to?" filled the gym. He reached for my shoulder, but when he reached, I pulled back, and all he got was my PE uniform shirt. Maybe that was what he wanted anyway. And I don't know if it was him reaching or me pulling back, but whatever it was, the whole stupid gym shirt got torn right down the whole way. Everything in the gym stopped. Again. But this time, it wasn't because I was mouthing off to Coach Reed. It was because of what they saw. And what they saw, it's not any of your stupid business. It got around the whole stupid school in probably a minute and a half. When I walked down the hall after P.E., it was like I was in a circle of silence. Ahead of me, people would be talking and laughing their heads off, and then they'd see me and stop talking. They'd hold their mouths shut like the funniest thing in the whole stupid world had just happened, and they wanted to bust out talking about it, but they couldn't until I walked by. So they'd watch until I got past them, and then wait a couple of seconds, and then I'd hear them start up again, laughing their heads off and talking, but low enough so I couldn't hear exactly. You know what this feels like? When I got to Mr. Ferris's class, I walked in the door to this. Otis Bottom was standing over a group of guys, and he's tall so he can look pretty threatening, and he was saying, "Shut up! Just shut up!" And Mr. Ferris was going over to calm things down, I guess, when everyone saw me come in, and everything went that eerie quiet. Mr. Ferris looked at me for a second and then said, "Let's all sit down and get started," except that I turned around and walked out. He came to the door and called after me, and I started running. So did he. We reached the front doors of Washington Irving Junior High School at the same time. He grabbed the bar handle so I couldn't open it. He grabbed the bar handle of the next door so I couldn't open it. And the next. I reared back and hit him in the stomach as hard as I could. I know, after school detention for life. Didn't care. He grabbed my arm. So I was crying by now. So what? So what? He walked me across the school lobby, slammed through the auditorium doors, shouted to the Washington Irving Junior High School brass quintet that they'd have to go practice somewhere else, now, which they did, in a hurry. He pushed me down into one of the auditorium chairs, sat next to me. He said, "Tell me." I tried to get up and he pushed me back down. "Tell me," he said again. So I did. How my father came home late on the night of my 12th birthday, and how he'd missed everything because he'd been with Ernie Echo,
how he sounded when my mother told him that. How he came up into my room with beer on his breath and told me we were going someplace for my birthday present and I should get dressed right now. How I said he didn't have to, and he smacked me and said he'd better not have to tell me again. How he'd taken me past my mother, who wasn't smiling. How we got into the beery car and he gunned it and said, hadn't I always said I wished I could have a tattoo like Lucas did? Hadn't I? I nodded because I was afraid not to. How we arrived at the mostly dark place and got out of the car and I said I wanted to go home, but he looked at me with beer in his eyes and said I better get in there, so I did. How I lay down on this couch, and my father talked with this guy, and they laughed, and my father covered my eyes with his beery hands because this was a present, and he was picking out a real surprise, and this fat, sweaty guy bent over me, and I could smell and feel him close when he pulled up my shirt. How it started, and I said it hurt, and my father pushed me down with his hand over my eyes, and said I'd better be still if I knew it was good for me, and so I did, even though I was crying then, too. How when it was done, after a long time, I looked into the mirror and saw the scroll and the flowers at each end and the words I couldn't read, so the fat, sweaty guy read them for me. Mama's baby. And I told Mr. Ferris how they both laughed and laughed and laughed and laughed and laughed. The funniest thing in the whole stupid world. Mama's baby. How I spent days trying to wash it off and then trying to scratch it off until it bled. How I hadn't gone swimming since then. How I changed for P.E. in the locker room stalls. How I wished he would... Mr. Ferris didn't say anything the whole time. He sat next to me and listened. And when I finished, I looked at him. He was crying. I'm not lying. He was crying. I don't think it was because of how hard I hit him. I know how the black-backed gull feels when he looks up into the sky. Maybe, somehow, Mr. Ferris does too. Chapter 5 The Yellow Shank. Plate 288. Here are the stats from the last 2 weeks of October. 3 fights in the downstairs hall. No wins, 1 loss, 2 ties. Mr. Ferris stopped them. 1 fight in Mr. McElroy's class with barbarian hordes. A tie. Mr. McElroy stopped it. 2 fights in the upstairs hall. No wins, 1 loss, 1 tie. Mr. Ferris stopped it. 2 fights in the P.E. locker room. 2 ties. Otis Bottom stopped them both, since the so-called gym teacher was nowhere around. 1 fight while running the cross-country course in P.E. 1 loss. 1 fight in the boys' bathroom. A tie. James Russell stopped it. 2 fights between school and the dump. No wins. 2 losses, but they were close. 12 near fights. Probable record, 8 wins, 4 losses. You don't believe me? So what? So what? 5 days of after-school detention. 2 threats of school suspension because I was the instigator of the P.E. locker room fights, according to the so-called gym teacher. Liar. Things were not going so well at Washington Irving Junior High School. Mr. Barber told me I needed to put a new brown paper book cover on Geography, the Story of the World, which I hadn't bothered doing since I was leaving it in my locker instead of bringing it to class, and I think Mr. Barber was starting to suspect that I'd taken his new book and destroyed it.
I hadn't turned in my chapter review map on the culture of China to Mr. McElroy, and no, I didn't know if I was going to get it done or not. Jane Eyre still hadn't figured out that she was in love with Mr. Rochester, and I mean, how many more clues do you need? I didn't raise my hand anymore in Mrs. Verne's class. And after the first time, I didn't bother answering even when she called on me, she stopped calling on me. I spent P.E. running the cross-country course while the rest of the class started in on the wrestling unit. No one said anything when I went out, not even the so-called gym teacher. And I didn't do anything on the next two lab experiments in Mr. Ferris's class. Lil did them both. Even the smelly chemical-y stuff. And so what that Apollo 7 successfully detached from the Saturn rocket to practice the rendezvous they would have to perform perfectly for a moonshot? So what that they landed a mere third of a mile from the landing site? So what? Clarence is a stupid toy horse. Who cares if he's rocking like anything? Because no matter where I went, in stupid Washington Irving Junior High School, there was the look and the laugh. And the smirk. Jerks. And no matter where I went in stupid Marysville, there was the look. And the laugh. And the smirk. Jerks. Do you know what that feels like? I stopped helping Miss Cowper with her county literacy unit. Who are we kidding? I did do the Saturday deliveries. Guess who wanted the money and wouldn't let me stop? I didn't meet Mr. Powell at the library afterward either. I don't know if Lil was waiting there or not. I didn't draw anymore. I didn't even want to. It was like the black-backed gull had laid its head down and given up the sky. So you can see why, on the day of the annual Ballard Paper Mill Harvest Time employee picnic, I wasn't overcome with happiness and joy. Neither was my father. It was pretty clear that Mr. Big Bucks Ballard was an idiot, he said, and that my father or Ernie Echo could run the paper mill blindfolded and do it better, 100 times better than he could, he said. All Mr. Big Bucks Ballard did was sit around his big office wearing his nice white shirt and silk tie and telling everyone else what to do, he said. But he never got his freaking hands dirty. No, he didn't. You never saw him at a forklift. You never saw him backing a truck into the loading dock. Wood pulp? Big Bucks Ballard wouldn't recognize it if he tripped and fell into it over his freaking head, he said. That's what happens when you get rich. You leave all the real work to the little guy, and you sit back and enjoy all the profits, he said. And it was going to take a whole lot more than a harvest time employee picnic to change things to the way they ought to be. When my father was home, and it wasn't often, since Ernie Echo came over most nights and they drove off together, but when he was home, that's pretty much what he told us. So no one wanted to go. Not to a picnic thrown by a jerk like Mr. Big Bucks Ballard. But on the last Saturday in October, my father made all of us get in the car and drive to the annual Ballard Paper Mill Harvest Time employee picnic, even my brother. You can imagine how happy we were. Especially when my father said that Mr. Big Bucks Ballard was the skinflint of skinflints, and there probably wouldn't be much to eat. And what there was wasn't going to be all that good. You don't expect a jerk and a skinflint to be grateful to his employees, do you? The only reason we were going, he said, was the trivia contest. And this trivia contest, according to Ernie Echo, was all about Babe Ruth. And who knew more about Babe Ruth than my father? No one. And I'm not lying. Do you know how many World Series home runs Babe Ruth hit? No, you don't. But my father did. 15. You probably know that in 1927, Babe Ruth hit his famous 60 home runs in a single season. But do you know when he hit 59 home runs? Probably you don't. But my father did. 1921. Do you know how many home runs Babe Ruth hit in the final game of 1928? 3. In one game. My father could tell you that and a whole lot more, because he had once met Babe Ruth. He shook Babe Ruth's hand and bought him a beer, and Babe Ruth had winked at him and said, "You're a hell of a good guy." My father loved Babe Ruth, and Ernie Echo said that the prize for the trivia contest was going to be a baseball signed by a Yankee. It was probably, Ernie Echo said, a baseball signed by the Babe. So we all went to the annual Ballard Paper Mill Harvest Time employee picnic because my father wanted to win a baseball signed by Babe Ruth. Terrific. I had to run through the Saturday morning deliveries pretty quickly, which wasn't hard, as you might remember, since not everyone knows the basic principle of physical science. Mrs. Mason hadn't ordered any donuts. Mr. Leffler didn't have a single light bulb to change. Mrs. Daugherty's kids were playing upstairs when I came, and Mrs. Windermere never came into the kitchen. I really wished that at least the Daugherty kids had been... So what? So what? I'm not a chump. I made it back as quickly as any human being could, which wasn't good enough for guess who. It was a Saturday that you somehow knew was going to be one of the last beautiful days of fall. The sun was shining hot, like it thought it was still July, and November drizzles were a whole season away. The sky was blue, and a few white clouds were easing themselves along like they didn't care. The grass was warm and sweet, like April, but the trees hadn't forgotten it was October. They were all on fire, and behind their leaves, the birds were singing their last songs. Waves of heat shimmered above the stone walls, and the granite sparkled. "Such a beautiful day," said my mother. My father didn't say anything. He was probably thinking about Babe Ruth. The annual Ballard Paper Mill Harvest Time employee picnic was always held at Mary's Lake, and since we got there late, we had to park about a mile away, all because, my father said, I hadn't finished the deliveries on time, not that it mattered, since Duggo couldn't hurry up if there were an atomic bomb on his butt. But even from a mile away, you could smell the chicken grilling as soon as you got out of the car, and you could hear hollering and cheering. People called and waved at each other as we walked toward the lake, and then they waved at us. And two women came to meet my mother and took her by the arms and brought her over to introduce her to someone else she had to meet because they didn't live very far from each other at all. And hadn't they seen her this fall at St. Ignatius? My father and brother and I passed by some long tables, and someone called out to us, and my father grunted back, and then the someone looked through a bunch of wrapped packages and picked two up and called to me and my brother and handed them to us. Inside was a Timex watch. I'm not lying. A Timex watch with a second hand and a real leather band and numbers for regular time and numbers for military time. A Timex watch. Compliments of the Ballard Paper Mill. My brother looked at me. I looked at him. Sometimes, and I know it doesn't last for anything more than a second, sometimes there can be perfect understanding between two people who can't stand each other. He smiled, and I smiled, and we put the Timex watches on, and we watched the seconds flit by. It was the first watch my brother had ever owned. It was the first watch I had ever owned. My father looked at our wrists. "The metal will turn your skin green," he said. "Wait and see." I did not know that so many people worked at the Ballard Paper Mill. It looked like all of Marysville was there. There was a group playing volleyball, and no one was even pretending to keep score. There was a baseball game going on, husbands against wives. I guess you can imagine how funny that was. My father went over to stand with Ernie Echo to laugh and smirk. There were about 10 guys throwing horseshoes, and the clangs and the cheers that came from them made it seem like it was all fired important, like it probably was to a bunch of chumps. I went down to the lake, and it was so hot that there was a whole bunch of kids swimming,
which I decided not to do because of you know why, and about 8 teams were doing chicken fights, and some were diving off each other's shoulders, and James Russell was there, and he waved at me to come in, but I shook my head, and he nodded. And drifting over everything was the smell of grilling chicken, and the snap of buttery fat when it fell in the fire, and the smoke that drew up over the baseball game and the volleyball and the horseshoes and drifted over to the rows of long tables with bright white cloths over them, where the women, including my mother, were setting out the bowls of salad and plates of rolls and pitchers of pink lemonade and platters of corn on the cob that were steaming and more bowls of salad until people started to crowd away from the baseball game, and then one of the cooks by the grills hollered out, "We're all set here." And everyone came and found a place in line while the cooks carried the long trays heaped with chicken. And the smell in the hot blue air was so wonderful. And I looked over at my mother and she was smiling to beat the band like she had come home after a long time away. It turned out that my brother was the first one in line. There's a shock. But it didn't matter. Because even if the whole town of Marysville had been there, they couldn't have eaten everything that was loading down those tables. It was like something out of a fairy tale. When a platter was empty, it got lifted away, and another one, even fuller than the first, magically appeared in its place. And there was more chicken cooking, and more vats of hot water with steaming corn, and then onto the line came all the kids from the lake who were dripping wet. And they were all hollering that it didn't matter if they ate like slobs because they were just going back into the water anyway. And then everyone finishing the salad and chicken and corn and trying to sit back and rub their stomachs. And then big aluminum carts being wheeled across the lawn. And every kid in the place running to them and reaching in for lime popsicles and strawberry shortcake and ice cream sandwiches. And James Russell grabbing me and yelling, "Come on!" And I was running over, too, and reaching in for an orange dreamsicle. An orange dreamsicle. You know how good an orange dreamsicle tastes on a blue fall day when you're full of grilled chicken and your mother is laughing a real laugh like she used to? And once you look over and your father is holding her hand like they haven't in a long, long, long time? Until Ernie Echo came and she walked away. Then all the mothers cleared the tables and swept off the long white tablecloths and, all laughing, folded them together and boxed up the extra food, and there was a lot. The kids ran down to the water again, and James Russell yelled, "Come on!" But I shook my head again. So he ran down to the lake, and I tried not to hate him when he took a flying dive and skimmed into the water, came up laughing, and some little kid was climbing on top of him for more chicken fights. Then most of the adults started to gather around the cleared tables, and I went over to the deserted horseshoe pits to see what was so all-fired important about throwing horseshoes. Someone yelled that the trivia contest was going to start soon, and everyone should choose a partner to work with. I looked back. My father was standing with Ernie Echo. They were whispering together. They'd probably win. I picked up a horseshoe and threw it. It came up short, by a lot. I tried another. It came up short again, by a lot. I heaved another, long, by a lot. Terrific. I threw the last one. It hit short again, but rolled until it flopped in the sand near the post. Not bad. Which is what an old guy said when I went to gather up the horseshoes. Not bad. But I think if you hold it on the bend, you might get a little more distance. I picked up the four horseshoes. You want to show me? He took a shoe and held it with the ends out. Like this, he said. He walked over to the post. You stand with your heel here and swing it back. He did this a couple of times. Then you release it on the upswing, which he did. It wasn't a ringer, but it clanged the post. Everything after that is just practice, he said. So I tried it. I stood with my heel like that,
and swung my arm a couple of times like that. I looked at him. He nodded. So I let one fly like that.